call the claim subcommittee to order, and I think the first order of business is approval of the minutes of the that we have before us for, I think they're November 8th. Do we have a motion for approval?
So moved.
So moved. Okay, that we have a motion to approve. Any discussion, additions, or corrections? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. This morning we're going to start off with a little discussion with regard to the needs of the victims and family survivor, or the survivors and family victims of the bridge collapse. And I know that Senator Latz has just been doing a terrific job of working with the governor's office and others on trying to find some answers to the immediate needs. And Senator Latz, maybe if you could give us a little update as to what I know some things have happened in a late-breaking situation or in a meeting as late as this morning. So, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since the last hearing, the governor's office and Representative Osmond and I have been having long discussions about how to approach some of these issues and trying to find some consensus and work around some of the legal obstacles that we've had to sort out. What we have, through some discussions late last night and again this morning, come up with is a proposal for the committee's consideration that would provide some emergency hardship relief for the families and the survivors that are experiencing some immediate financial needs. And so what I'd like to do is to kind of outline the proposal, and I think the plan is to maybe not to sort through a broad discussion of it right away, but to move forward with some of the other testimony and then try to put it all into context, although I'm happy, to answer any questions right away if there are any. So why don't I just go ahead and outline the proposal. It's a joint recommendation or proposal from Governor Pawlenty, myself, and Representative Osmond. The proposal would utilize up to $1 million in existing appropriation authority that the Commissioner of Finance has from two funds that were filled in the last budget cycle. That would be a combination of the general fund, tort claims fund, and the trunk highway fund, tort claims fund. There are separate line item appropriations in each of those funds specifically to deal with tort claims. That money would be available for claimants who were on the bridge at the time of the collapse and who suffered physical injury as a result of the collapse or death. So then, of course, it would be their family members that would make this a request on their behalf. Could request interim payment for lost wages. For lost wages resulting from the physical injury or the death. To enable the more prompt handling of these claims, the Department of Administration's Risk Analysis Division and their claims adjusters, a company called Allied, would process the claims using the existing claims process that they've already initiated. There would be a request. A person would have to make a formal claim on their own behalf or on behalf of a deceased family member, requesting interim payment, and the Attorney General's office would be involved in fashioning the specific legal documents that would be connected with the release of the funds. The lost wages payments would be based upon existing no-fault reimbursement processes. So it will be modeled on the auto no-fault law. That's one reason lost wages is the particular reference point for this. And it would be based on a no-fault basis, so there wouldn't be any need to deal with any liability questions or issues. Simply, if you were present on the bridge, receive physical injury or death as a result of the collapse, you could make a claim for lost wages. There are only limited number of funds available in these two pots of money. The original appropriations, as I recall, were $1.2 million in the Trunk Highway Fund, tort claims line, over the biennium, over the two-year cycle. And I think $635,000 or about that in the more general fund tort claims section. And Commissioner of Finance will be able to put a finer point on that if need be. Some of that money has already been used for just dealing with tort claims against the state in other contexts. So not all of it is available for this purpose, and some of it will have to be reserved for dealing with stuff as well. So that's why the proposal right now is to use up to $1 million of that. I think as I'm looking back on some of my notes, I might be off on the general fund money. I've got a $322,000 figure. I'm seeing heads nod in the audience. So the corrected figure is the accurate one, $322,000 for the biennium in the general fund tort claims fund. So subtracting money that's already been used and anticipating for other pending needs, we've got a $1 million available. Because of that limited availability, the interim payment or the emergency hardship payment would be capped at $10,000 per claimant for the first 30 days of the program. And once claims experience is evaluated, once, frankly, we get an idea of how many people make claims, how great the need is, how much money is in fact likely to be used, we could look at raising that cap. But for starters, in order to be fair to everyone who might bring a claim, if 100 people brought a claim at $10,000 cap, that's $1 million. Now, maybe only 50 people will bring claims to tap into this particular pot of money, and that would mean there might be more available for some of the others who might have needs or claims that are greater than that $10,000. But that would be reexamined after the initial processing of the claims. The payments would be limited to lost wages not already compensated from other sources. So, for example, someone who has received lost wages as part of a workers' compensation program or disability insurance or other relief funds administered by other perhaps charitable agencies, they would not be entitled to a second payment for lost wages. The purpose of these emergency funds is to help people who are not otherwise finding funds to get them through their initial financial hardship. The payments would be made pursuant to Minnesota Statute 604.01, which was a statute brought to our attention by President-elect Michael Ford of the Minnesota State Bar Association. As the last witness at our last hearing, brought this to our attention. It specifically provides for advance payments on potential future resolution or settlements of claims. And it comes with some caveats, if you will, or understandings that those advance payments are, in fact, advance against any future settlement. So if there is a future settlement, this payment is offset or deducted from future settlement amounts. It's not an admission of liability or anything like that. And it's got a variety of other things which get into some technical legal questions, but which in any case would be something that would be a part of any advance payments, but here we've got the specific statute to identify for it. The settlement would not be admissible in any subsequent adjudicatory proceedings. So if there were a future lawsuit, judicial proceedings, the fact that there was an advance payment made here would not be admissible and would not have any effect whatsoever on those proceedings. And then the claims committee would, frankly, consider and make a recommendation if it's the will of the committee here today to make a recommendation for that the Commissioner of Finance go ahead and implement this proposal. So that's the basic outline of the proposal. This is also intended to supplement perhaps in some ways move in concert with or even beyond what the charitable organizations have been doing. They're looking at broader questions. They're dealing with questions of medical expenses that aren't covered and some other things as well. And this process would avoid going into specific questions of having to prove, the scope or extent of injury, reviewing extensive medical records and stuff like that. I think it is anticipated that a letter from a medical provider simply documenting the fact that there were injuries and that they were suffered in connection with the bridge collapse would be sufficient proof to qualify for these interim funds and would give would hopefully avoid any false claims or people coming in with claims that wouldn't qualify for this particular type of fund. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's the proposal.
Okay. Are there any questions of Senator Letts? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And those of us on the committee, this is first we've heard of it as well. So we're still all learning the details. And I'd like to understand why the limitation to lost wages. We don't know the circumstances of all the people on the bridge, but given its location, I expect some were students who were not able to continue their studies and maybe living on, we're living on student financial aid. If someone were unemployed at that point in time or had recently been laid off, they still have living expenses. Is there a reason within how we set this up and the structure that wouldn't permit us to recognize other needs and also to look at the issue of, there are a lot of children on the bridge who had potentially some, they may or may not have been insured and may have had some medical needs. Do we know that those are being met through the charitable funds at this point so that they're not going to have an interim need at this point?
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, those are all good questions. The theory for focusing on the lost wages was twofold. One is that generally speaking, it's not as susceptible to subrogation based on the auto no-fault model. If someone were injured in an auto accident and they received no-fault payments for lost wages, by state statute, as I understand it, that those payments are not subject to subrogation or recovery by other third-party payers. Secondly, the theory was that at least a good portion of the immediate financial hardship that might be felt by a family would be because of a person's inability to continue bringing in income to enable them to pay the mortgage or pay for food. If they were already had other sources of income that they were using for that purpose other than wages, such as perhaps student loans, or if they were a non-working spouse, or they were a child that had parents that were working, then that income source was not interrupted by the injuries resulting from the bridge collapse. So at least theoretically, the immediate financial hardship would not be as apparent. So that was the theory.
Just a follow-up to that. And I'm pleased that we found a source of funds that we can use and access before we convene again in February. I mean, I think that's a step forward. At the same time, I'm just trying to anticipate, equity issues that are going to be raised by people who had other types of circumstances in their life. And I know that the loss of the paycheck is obviously critical in terms of making your rent or mortgage payments. But we've heard a lot about how some people have had to incur, extraordinary expenses that weren't part of that normal budget just in terms of the kinds of physical health supports that they needed, home modifications, those sorts of things. And so I'm just wondering, and I know that this is just a start, and it's, you know, given the limited funds, but I'm just wondering if there's some people who are going to find some gaps, and if we're, at least as we implement this, I think it's really critical that we get as much information as we can about the people who don't fit within this framework so that we at least have a better understanding going into the more final solution of who's out there, what their needs are, what the circumstances are.
Senator Lass.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. And one thing that we did not want to do was duplicate the efforts of the Minneapolis Foundation and the United Way, which I understand have 70 or 80 cases open where they have caseworkers assigned to gather more information and to on injuries, on perhaps extraordinary medical expenses and stuff like that, and to distribute funds as well to try to address some of those interim needs. This would not be duplicative of those efforts. It would be supplementary to those efforts perhaps a little bit more speedy because we're not going to require an extensive the theory anyway is there won't be required an extensive documentation process. If someone can show, you know, their paycheck stub and somehow prove they haven't been able to work since then, or they went through 2 months where they weren't able to work, and get a letter from the doctor, the idea is that will be enough rather than having to redo, you know, open up a whole casework file and work through the process of getting medical records and figuring out the extent of medical expenses, what was covered by insurance, what wasn't covered by insurance. The other opportunity here is to help make sure that people who do submit claims in this process get referred to Kim Peck in the administration, who is kind of acting as the ombudsperson to coordinate accessibility to other programs and funds that are available through just the regular work of state government, like rehabilitative services that perhaps some of the survivors are not as aware of or haven't been plugged into yet. There can be funds available through some of those programs that would have their own, you know, eligibility criteria. And we've talked about this, you and I have talked about this separately. You've raised this point in the past, and hopefully this will be a way to help get people directed to the resources that are already available through state government as well.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
On our last meeting, I think it was the San Francisco bridge collapse, we learned that they had done a $25,000 emergency-type payment similar to this. Between then and now, has anybody been able to find out how they might have worked around the same ERISA concerns that came up that the insurance company may get those dollars instead of the victims?
Senator Lass.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I know there are a lot of people working on the ERISA questions. I don't know if we've gathered any specific information about California. Maybe we'll learn a little bit more later, although I'm seeing Senate counsel indicating we haven't specifically sorted out the California experience with ERISA. ERISA is a federal law, and so you really need an act of Congress probably to change the applicability of ERISA to the self-funded insurance plans. You know, in California, they handled the whole thing differently. They actually called a special session. The legislature made a special appropriation around $30 million early on to deal with that. But they had a different legal landscape in California, too. And for better or for worse, they had a lot of experience dealing with catastrophic-type claims. They've had bridge collapses before. They've had they've had earthquakes mm-hmm. before that have caused their state government to have in place a process for dealing with stuff like this. Fortunately, we haven't had that past experience, but that's left us with a little bit of catch-up to do in terms of structure and approach.
A follow-up, if I may.
Senator Olson.
I appreciate the work that's been done here. I think this is what my intention was, is that we do something right away, although we're, 4 months out? And almost 4 months out, so right away. But at least we're moving in the right direction, I feel. And I like also what you say that by capping it at 10,000 for the first 30 days and then seeing where we're at. I mean, I suspect some people may have recovered and their injuries were minor enough that they're back to their normal lives, and I know some people certainly aren't. So there may very well be money, as I suspect you alluded to, that that cap could be raised. Thanks.
Other questions? I'd like to Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a practical question about how this would work. I mean, are people, since it's for lost wages, I assume it's payments for wages lost up to the time you make the claim, so that if you applied, say, January 1st, it would be your losses from August 1st till January 1st. And I just want to make sure that there's nothing in our using the tort claims process that's being proposed that wouldn't prohibit people from filing again on, say, February 1st, since it has to be lost wages as opposed to prospective lost wages. I'm just trying to understand sort of the practicalities of the format that you've proposed we administer this, if there's any limitations on number of the claims, if they have to file every month. Most people, you know, and how fast could we process the payment to them? So if they filed on January 1st, do we assume that administration and the Department of Finance should be able to get that out fairly, turned around fairly quickly? Have we been able to look? I know this is fairly new if you've just worked it out last night, but do we have any sense, or maybe there's some state agency people who could assist us in kind of getting a sense of what people might expect in terms of how quickly this might help them? I know some people have talked about how they're living off of Visa cards, which is not a good way to run your budget, no matter what your circumstances.
Senator Lass.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I don't think the proposal was intended to be limited to only wages that you've lost so far, and then you can never recover any lost wages that you'll experience, say, in the next month. So lost wages was not identified as past or future specifically. I don't expect you to be making payments right now for future wage loss, but I would expect that subject to whatever cap ends up applying, that it would be open to reapply if you still haven't gone back to work yet. Now, that level of detail wasn't worked out in our proposal.
Other questions? Well, Senator Lass, I want to thank you for your work on this, and I also want to clarify my understanding. This is an emergency fund or emergency dollars that are being made available to deal with the circumstances that people are confronted with right now. This is not something that is going to be is taking the place of or working on the Special Victims Fund. I know that there are others that are working on that, and that would have a more long-term impact. This is just to take care of those concerns that were raised before our committee last time, and this is a potential last committee hearing. We had a potential answer on how to deal with it more rapidly, and this is the attempt to do that. Is that my am I correct in that understanding?
That's my understanding as well, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. Let's see. Why don't we start with the Minnesota Department of Administration. They're going to speak to us about the ability to handle these claims, and if you'd introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name's Tom Chuckle. I'm the claims manager for the state of Minnesota for property and casualty claims with the Department of Administration. I sent over a handout that describes on the first page the structure of our claims department, and you'll see that we have myself and four staff members, three of which are adjusters and two of which are liability adjusters. On the next page, it describes one of the two functions we handle, handling claims for the state. We have claims that are insured through our agency. The Risk Management Fund is a self-insured fund similar to an insurance company. We collect premium and handle claims out of that premium fund. This is the structure, and you'll see that our department has assistance through Allied Adjusters, which is a third-party claims administrator. We use Allied Adjusters because it would be impractical to hire enough adjusters within the metropolitan area to handle claims that occur statewide and even in other states. But we do try to minimize the use of outside assistance. I've given some claim numbers here in the chart to show the dollars involved in the typical claims we handle for the state through the insured fund, as well as the volume of claims. And these are strictly liability claims. On the next page, the state also, we handle for the state through the Attorney General's office, non-insured claims. There are certain areas of business where insurance is not practical to purchase. And for instance, the Department of Transportation does not have general liability coverage through the state. It's not practical. They have typically got a budget big enough to handle the claims that they get from year to year out of their budget. But we do assist them in handling the claims from a technical standpoint. And again, we have the assistance of Allied Adjusters to work statewide. Claims that go into suit are referred to the Attorney General's office, and they handle them from that point on. And that is basically the structure of our department. You'll notice that we have a fairly small staff, but we've been managing to handle the claims for the state now for 20 years. I did want to turn it over for questions, but respond to Representative Loeffler's question earlier. Typically, when you pay wage loss, you get a doctor's explanation of not able to work up to a certain period of time. You'll make a payment up to that period of time. 2 weeks later, you can get an update from the physician and make a supplemental payment after that. So that's an ongoing thing.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chuckle, do you have any sense of the question I'd asked earlier about the processing time that people might expect?
Mr. Chair, committee members, a lot of that depends on the response time of physicians, employers to provide wage information, and the claimants themselves. Upon receipt of this information in our department, our goal is to process those things within 2 weeks, but no later than 30 days.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate that. Now I have Mr. Watson from Senate Counsel.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Peter Watson, W-A-T-T-S-O-N. I'm Senate Counsel for the Finance Committee. I have put together for you, it should be in your packets, a list of questions and answers. And I'd like to go through that with you now. Former Senator and now Judge Randy Peterson once said, being a legislator wouldn't be half bad if it weren't for all the decisions you have to make. Well, unfortunately, that kind of is the job of a legislator, and that's the job of this committee. To make decisions, you need to have information, but you also need to have values. The questions and answers listed here are roughly in order of their primary importance. Primary decisions, primary questions first, and secondary ones later. So that the answers you make to the first questions on this list will tend to guide you in what questions you're going to have to answer later on down the list. Information may be true or false or somewhere in between, and it may be current and solid, or it may be in the process of development, or it may be something that you're just not going to get until a later time. The time for this document, it was printed out on November 28th, which was yesterday, but it actually, I wrote it on the 14th, so that any answers that are in here are at least 2 weeks old, and they will be updated with the information that we provide to you today. What I hope to do is go through first just the list of questions and preliminary answers so you get a feel for what's here, and then have you begin again at the beginning to have your own discussions as to what your values tell you the decisions ought to be and those areas where you think you have solid enough information to be able to make a decision. Where you need more information, the several staff here from Senate Counsel and House Research and Senate Fiscal Analysis are prepared with additional papers, spreadsheets, and so forth to bring you up to date to where we are now. And you'll get a feeling for, I think, what information is solid and not going to change and what is in the process of being developed and what just isn't going to be available for maybe quite a while now. So if I might begin at the top, the first question is whether the current law is adequate. And I think you came to a sense at the last meeting that the current law was not adequate in those several points mentioned there. If it isn't adequate, then what should be done about it? Should we be looking at an amendment to the permanent law, Section 3.736, or provide some kind of a special exemption for some of the provisions, or should there be a totally new fund that might be set up to compensate victims of a disaster? Third question, who might the subcommittee get help from in trying to establish the procedures to provide compensation if indeed you decide that you do want to provide compensation? We heard from Mr. Feinberg at the last meeting, got some information from California, New York, and Minnesota at the last meeting. You can call in those people listed or others to get further information as you desire on establishing the kind of procedure that you want. Fourth was the question whether the state can pay victims without admitting liability. I think the answer to that at the last meeting was clearly yes. Fifth, can the state pay emergency compensation to victims before their total eligibility has been determined? I think the answer to that one at the last meeting was clearly yes. Sixth, can the state compensate victims only for their uninsured losses and deny their insurance companies the right to subrogate? Well, we've had considerable discussion on that. It appears to be maybe yes for some and no for others, and maybe there is a way around it by crafting careful language. We can get into that more, and in particular, Ms. Pontius is prepared to talk to you more about the subrogation issues. There may be others here as well. Seventh, if something is to be done, what will it cost? First, as to the overall limit, the $1 million limit, how many victims do we have? We have some preliminary information. Mr. Mossman and Ms. Roberts will provide you with a spreadsheet that shows where we are now in figuring out the number of victims and the kinds of losses that they have, and you'll see that we have better information on some of these than on others. The second question is, should the $300,000 limit be increased or waived, well, what would be the impact of that? What, how many victims have had losses exceeding 300,000? Is it one or a few or a whole bunch? And what are the causes of those excess losses? If there are those losses and we get a handle on what they are in excess of the $300,000 a person, what mechanism would work better, raising the limit or waiving perhaps for certain kind of expenses? Eighth, who might help the subcommittee gather information on victims' losses? We've got information potentially coming from the city of Minneapolis. I think Ms. Roberts and Ms. Mossman will give you some of that. From Hennepin County, I'm not sure what we may have gotten from them. Likewise, we've gotten some information from MnDOT and Risk Management on the claims that have been filed to date, and I don't believe anything has been settled or paid out, but we can hear more from them. As time goes by, there may be lawsuits filed, and you'll want to hear more from the Attorney General and get some kind of an update perhaps from Mr. Messerly and Mr. Schwabel on how all that is going. So those are the questions that I saw as of 2 weeks ago that were kind of before the committee and arranged, I hope, in an orderly way that would allow you to plow through them and come up with some answers.
Okay, questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Watson, I appreciate your coming and testifying. I wanted just to ask you on the memo that we've got in our packet that is dated today, use of trunk highway funds to pay tort claims. And as I have looked at this morning, it seems as if what you're suggesting is that there's a constitutional issue with the use of the highway funds for paying tort claims, and yet the proposal that we've discussed briefly would say we should do that. And I just wondered if you would want to comment on this, and what is the point you're making, that we should amend the Constitution or continue to follow past practice and do it anyway, or what's the recommendation that you're offering us here?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, I think what the memo shows is that notwithstanding the court's decision of 1930, the legislature has continued to make payments of highway negligence claims out of the trunk highway fund, and they've done it in a variety of ways. Between 1931 and 1975, what they often did was say, okay, court, you want to make the final decision on the claim? You make the final decision on the claim. And the courts apparently went ahead and authorized the payment of those claims. Because remember, what the court had said in 1930 was that it was not appropriate to be paying these claims out of the trunk highway fund when there was no liability on the part of the state. So the legislature turned bunches of cases over to the courts, and they decided whether there should be liability or not and the amount to be paid. But we also had a system whereby in many of those years, you'll see, although some claims were sent to the courts, there were other claims that were paid without going to court. So apparently this dual system, sometimes involving the court, sometimes not, went on for 45 years, and with claims being paid by the courts out of the trunk highway fund. So since 1976, when the law was changed to say that the state is liable for these kinds of claims, the legislature, to my knowledge, has not referred any particular claims to court. Maybe they have, but I didn't see any. So I think as a matter of practical construction, we've got now 77 years of history that says, yes, it can be done.
Other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watson, thank you for your long list of really thinking through all the details. There's one other type of potential claim, and it could be run through a victim's claim, or it could be handled more directly, and that I have heard, but I don't have confirming information yet, that the medical costs were not eligible for the federal emergency response funds like the police and the sheriff department's funds were. And specifically, like even the ambulance runs from the site, we're not eligible for those specifically under the federal authorization. And I know there were discussions going on with FEMA between Hennepin County and FEMA trying to determine what, if anything, would qualify for their reimbursement, but that would only be at 75%. And so there'd be a remaining 25%. And so there's, I think, costs associated with uncompensated care, medical care from a variety of hospitals potentially in treating the uninsured. We've talked about the issue of people who have ERISA insurance versus non-ERISA insurance, but there's also another group we need to think about, which is that group that didn't have insurance but have care. I think most hospitals are respectful and aren't sending bills to the victims, so I don't know that that's being tallied up yet, but that might be an issue. And even the morgue costs, I understand of the medical examiner trying to determine, you know, cause of death and identifying remains was also not going to be fully compensated, and that's something that I'm just raising as an issue that we may, as a state, have to deal with at some point as this arises. And I suspect that the only place that holds that information is the county or the hospitals, because I think typically hospitals are pretty respectful in not sending the bills to an uninsured person when they know the circumstances in the situation, although I don't have information that that's the case. I think that's more typical.
Senator Hand.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Watson, just wanted to, one other question that occurs to me here, again referring to the memo that you wrote us about the use of trunk highway funds. And on the bottom of the first page, you refer to a statute, 161.20 subdivision 3, that was enacted in 2000, that where the language it says that tort claims are explicitly denied from trunk highway fund appropriations. Is that, as we proceed, is that something that we should, in your view, revisit and amend that law to allow us to do what we are contemplating doing? I mean, if we have something in statute that says we can't do this and we do it anyway, it seems to raise a little bit of question in my mind about whether we're following the law. But if we're going to do it, we have the power to change the law. Is that part of your thought, that we should do that and change the statute to allow us to do what we want to do?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, that issue has a lot of history in the Transportation Committee, and we have somebody here who is familiar with that history and can maybe tell us something about it. Senator Arata was one who, as you know, was very concerned about that issue, and as I understand it, he was the person who took the lead in getting this language put in. And there was a year, 2001, where indeed the legislature paid highway tort claims out of the general fund, but after that they resumed paying highway tort claims out of the trunk highway fund. That's just what the legislature has done. But if you want to know more about the blow-by-blow of the Transportation Committee, you'll have to ask someone else who is here.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I have not been on that committee and haven't been engaged in that blow-by-blow debate over the years. It does strike me, though, that if we have passed a law as recently as 2000 that in explicit language says we can't do this and we do it anyway, it seems to me that if that's what we would want to do, if that's the will of the legislature to do that, then we ought to amend the law. Just say, let's strike that prohibition of paying torts out of the highway fund. And if our intention is to do it, we ought to not have a law that prohibits it. I think that makes us look, I think it puts us in a poor light. But I'm not familiar with the history on what has happened in the Transportation Committee. Maybe there's others who are more knowledgeable and experienced than I am on that can help bring some light to that. But it would seem to me that if we want to proceed as we're talking about, it might make sense to address this in the statute.
Other questions? Okay, do you have further testimony?
Mr. Chairman, I have nothing further other than to encourage you to start back up at question number one and see how far you can get. And as I said, there are people here who are prepared to give you more information on any of these issues where you think you need more information.
Okay. If others would that want to, I had there were several on the agenda. That's you're speaking for all of them, I assume, at this point.
Yeah. Unless, would you rather have each of them come up and make a presentation on their area?
If they're members, is that what you'd?
Well, I think that we were like to get some of the answers of questions that have been raised. We probably should proceed like that.
Why don't you have them come to the table with you? And I don't know. Let's see, we have listed here Kathy Pontius, Matt Massman, Bonnie, and I'm not going to try that.
Berezovsky.
Okay.
Berezovsky.
And others. Any want to come up and make a presentation or any information that you think we should hear?
Mr. Chairman, might I suggest that on this list, the first issue that comes up that one of these people is prepared to testify is the subrogation issue on question six, and that would be on Ms. Pontius.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning.
Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Kathleen Pontius, counsel for the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I'm just going to talk very briefly about just subrogation issues and what the concept of subrogation means. You know, I'd sort of add that this is probably an issue that's going to be more relevant down the road when the legislature might be considering, you know, a more ambitious compensation plan than obviously what you can do today without legislation. I think there have been concerns and questions that have come up during your discussions regarding the extent that the state may compensate victims, but in turn will others have, in particular insurance companies, then have a right to subrogation to essentially recover the funds that the state is paying out. There are sort of some bigger picture subrogation issues that you might get into if you have a more ambitious fund, you know, things like, well, should, if the state is paying compensation, should the state at some point have subrogation rights against third parties who may be found to be negligent and primarily liable in any claims that would arise in the future? How does that interplay with things like the rights of the victims to elect other remedies? You know, do you want to condition receipt of money from the fund on a waiver of remedies? So these are a number of issues to think about kind of down the road as you're considering other types of legislation. Basically, the definition of subrogation involves one person who performs a duty of another person, which then makes them subrogated to the rights of the person who's owed the duty. Now, that's kind of a convoluted legal definition, but the most common form is an insurance company. And when an insurance company pays a claim caused by the negligence of another, they then have subrogation rights against another party who actually caused the harm. Basically, if you can think of the insurance company as sort of stepping into the shoes of the insured, and so they can then sue any party who the insured could have sued to compensate them for the loss that was paid. Subrogation rights can exist in a number of different areas. It might be expressed or implied under common law. There are a number of statutes in Minnesota that deal with subrogation, either creating rights, limiting rights, or regulating the circumstances under which they can be exercised. For example, I think Senator Latz mentioned earlier that with respect to the proposal, the interim stopgap proposal that you were looking at this morning with respect to just payments for lost income, because there are no subrogation rights for that under the no-fault law. And, in fact, there's a fairly complex statute and detailed statute under no-fault that deals with subrogation and the relationships between different insurance companies. There's also a statute dealing with health plan subrogation issues. That's Minnesota Statute Section 62A.095. It doesn't specifically address subrogation rights, but it does regulate subrogation clauses that are in health plans. And if a plan does have a subrogation clause or a reimbursement clause or some similar type of clause in it that allows the health plan company to recover medical payments made from a third party who might actually be the underlying cause of the injury, they have to, first of all, they can only exercise those clauses if there has been full recovery for those injuries from another source. There's also special rules governing recovery of attorney fees. You know, if a party spends money to get a recovery, then the insurance company has to bear part of the burden of getting that recovery. There's also a prohibition on retroactive amendments that are to the disadvantage of the insured. And I think probably anybody who's ever gone in to see a doctor for some kind of an injury is either at the time of the office visit or maybe afterwards you've gotten a form from your health plan company. You know, was this injury work-related? Was it the result of an automobile accident or some other accident? Well, what the health plan company is trying to find out is there somebody else, maybe with against whom we would have subrogation rights for those medical expenses that are paid? The workers' compensation statute also has, it's 176.061, has a provision dealing with third-party liability. There are provisions dealing with the ability to bring legal proceedings against a third party who's not the employer under specified circumstances. For example, the employer, the employee's dependents, the employer, or the attorney general in the case of individuals who receive money from the state compensation fund can bring a lawsuit regardless of whether workers' compensation benefits have been paid. But then if there is, let's say, if the employee then gets a recovery, then those may be that recovery may in turn be deducted from the benefits. And just, I think, as a general observation, there are a number of different options available to the legislature where you could address concerns regarding any impact that subrogation rights might have on victim recoveries from any type of special compensation fund that you create. You know, where it's going to become most critical or problematic is where you start looking at compensating for losses that were insured. If you're not getting into insured losses, then I think the subrogation issues are less relevant. And the main sort of constraint on what you can do is that you have to be careful that you structure or frame any provisions in a way that avoids any unconstitutional impairment of contract, because a number of insurance policies are going to contain subrogation clauses in them. And, you know, you have to sort of think this through carefully in your drafting. There was a discussion a little bit earlier on the ERISA issues. I will confess up front I am totally unfamiliar with that area, other than to know that there's kind of a super preemption under ERISA, and any time that ERISA issues come to play, it does get to be somewhat a complex analysis, but I can't provide any more insight on that particular aspect of it right now. I think what you'd probably want to do if you are concerned about, you know, insurance companies end up being, say, the beneficiaries of any special compensation paid to victims, is you know, first of all, you can specify that the payments are intended to be a special compensation beyond what they might have recovered from insurers or other collateral sources, that they're not a duplicative benefit. You could explicitly state that they are not subject to subrogation claims, and that the creation of the fund is not intended to be an admission of any legal duty or the creation of any legal duty or obligation on the part of the state, because that's sort of when subrogation comes into play, is you've got an insurance company paying for someone else's legal duty. Your legislation could say, we're not creating a legal duty, we're just trying to compensate victims here. Somewhat similar to what you would do, you know, with these interim settlements where you're not admitting liability, you're just trying to make payments out, you know, as sort of a preliminary settlement to compensate victims. You know, I think that would be would probably get more important to the extent that you were looking at a broader bill where, say, you were either compensating for other losses, pain and suffering losses, looking at maybe not only just waiving caps, but perhaps, you know, waiving immunities as well, like the potential discretionary function immunity. You could also explicitly prohibit claims against victims, say by insurers or against the fund, based on money recovered from the fund. And it's certainly possible that, depending on what your structure, that the insurance companies might raise an impairment of contract challenge to it. I think it's important to note that despite pretty what seems like broad language in the state and federal constitutions, that in fact the courts have construed the contract clause as not being strict or an absolute prohibition on impairments. First of all, you have to find that there was actually an impairment to begin with. I think that's why it would be important to include language in anything that you do, saying we're not creating a duty, we're not saying there is a duty here, we're sort of creating something that didn't exist before, a new way of compensating victims. So you're not really impairing the contract, you're sort of just expanding beyond what the insurer might have had as far as opportunities to sue other third parties. And even if you find that there is an impairment, then the courts sort of go through this three-tiered analysis. First of all, they look, was the impairment substantial? If it was, then did the state demonstrate a significant and legitimate public purpose behind the legislation? And if so, then was any adjustment of rights and responsibilities under the contract based on reasonable conditions and appropriate to the public purpose that's being served? So, Mr. Chairman, those are just some very general thoughts I put together in a limited period of time. I'd be happy to look at some of the issues more for you or answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Senator Olsen.
I know you said this, but I didn't understand it. So, under a scenario, let's say, because Secretary Peters has said that the National Transportation Safety Board will have their decision on why the bridge collapsed in approximately a year or so. So let's say that an emergency payment is distributed, and then during the session we do a compensation of X amount of dollars. If this plays out then that there is somebody who is liable, can we place, I heard you say a lien on any kind of payments the state makes, and then if a survivor is awarded a settlement, that the state could be paid back those dollars?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, I think you're asking what would the state or could the state have sort of subrogation rights in the sense that the state could then recover its money back from the third, say, the construction company or engineer or whomever?
Yes.
That would be possible. I think the most desirable approach would be to specify all that in the legislation itself. Decide what you want to happen and then put it into the law.
And I have a burning question, Mr. Chair, probably isn't you to answer, but has anybody researched the survivors and found out how many people actually have, what kind of insurance plans they have, if there are any of these ERISA plans out there? Because I think I heard somebody say that one of the testifiers last time, I think, had an ERISA plan. But I don't know how many of the folks do, and that's maybe a number we need to get.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lass.
Mr. Chairman, the witness who testified on that last time is here, actually. It's Chris Messerly, a lawyer representing some of the claimants. He said then, and he's reiterated now, that he believes most people are covered through ERISA plans in their health insurance or medical coverage rather than what used to be considered a more traditional insurance program.
Mr. Chairman, I can assist maybe on that.
Senator Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In my other responsibilities here at the legislature, I've had to deal with ERISA more. And in Minnesota, for those who are privately insured, not under medical assistance or public Minnesota Care, the public programs, about two-thirds, I believe, of the people with health insurance are in self-insured plans. And an ERISA plan just means that you have a normal card. I had several of the victims come up to me after the last meeting and ask me, well, how do I find out if I'm in an ERISA plan? And basically you can call either your insurer, whosoever card you have, or your employer would know as well whether they are self-insured or not. But what they do, to an individual, it looks like you can, for example, if you're in Health Partners, you could be Health Partners fully insured, or you could be Health Partners under ERISA. And under ERISA, the Health Partners is just contracted to administer the plan, and your employer is assuming the risk rather than the insurance company. But I think we need to think carefully about whether we're going to treat people differently based on what their employer choice of a plan was. That's something that they didn't have any input into. And so I think we really need to kind of weigh this one in those complex equity issues as we move forward.
Other questions? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Pontius, thank you for coming. I wanted to, in your testimony, you talked about that the state has not had or not made any claim to have the right to subrogate for payments in the past. And you mentioned that if we want to do that, we should make that explicit in whatever statute we write. And I'm just curious to know, why is it that the state has never taken the position of doing that? And is there any danger in us asserting that right? And just give us a little bit of background on why the state has never taken that kind of position. Do you have any help on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, I haven't looked at what the legislature has done in the past. I vaguely recall, I think it was there was a hazardous waste compensation fund created back in the 80s that was in existence for a while that I think did have subrogation rights as part of it. But I think this is kind of any time you create a unique fund, I think that's one of the issues you want to look at. Either say that, you know, the state does or doesn't have them, depending on what you want. And then also look at, along with that, whether you see this as an exclusive remedy for the victims versus wanting to retain their right to still pursue litigation against other potential defendants as well. Because, like I think in the testimony on the 9/11 fund, that was an exclusive remedy, as I understand it. There, of course, the overriding concern was the potential disruption that might result to the airline industry if it was subject to a lot of litigation arising out of 9/11 victim claims. And as a result, this fund was somewhat unique in that respect.
Senator Olsling.
If we do something like a victim's compensation, are we setting the state up for precedence then that, or maybe I did hear you say that this could be a one-time only, how the law is structured? I guess that's kind of the key, isn't it?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsling, yes. I mean, you want to structure it carefully to accomplish just what you want to accomplish. But I do think it's important to think about all these issues when you're drafting whatever you decide to do.
Well, I'm hopeful that you guys will have some input.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I continue my law school and legislative service, I have a number of questions, and thank you, Ms. Pontius, for your continuing assistance and learning these things. Both in terms of the potential emergency short-term funds as well as long-term potential, in addition to subrogation, is this subject to dunning? You know, that's debt repayments or revenue recapture, so that if you had, say, a father who isn't making his child support payments because he isn't getting income right now and it's subject to revenue recapture through their state, you know, where the state can take part of their income tax refund or whatever, or they've got creditors who want to file claims. I mean, is this a risk, or do we need to address that in establishing these payment mechanisms as well, that their creditors could start to control by their putting liens against these payments what's left to pay the mortgage as opposed to what goes to the Sears bill or something else?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I think with respect to the Revenue Recapture Act, that very specifically is limited to capturing income tax refunds. As far as other types of creditors, you know, there might be some potential there, I suppose, for like if say the person has been using their Visa card to pay the bills and now they can't pay the Visa card, but they've gotten a special compensation from the state, and so then Visa turns around and gets a judgment against them. And may try to capture some of those funds I mean, you could put something specifically in the statute that they were exempt from execution. Because, I mean, there are a number of exemptions in the statute. Nothing jumps to mind, you know, like any kind of welfare benefits are exempt. A lot of public assistance, any types of public assistance are exempt. I don't think this would fall within any of the current exemptions.
Mr. Lindeke.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, and Representative Loeffler, a number of years ago we added claims paid by the claims subcommittee to the Revenue Recapture Act so that every claim that this subcommittee pays goes first through revenue recapture and then to the claimant. So we should be very careful that we don't pay these claims if we intend them to go to the claimants. And if the claim, because it'll go to revenue recapture first. Perhaps if it goes through risk management and they pay the claims, that would not be a problem. I don't know.
And we're, I think that we'd be making a recommendation if would be the only thing that this committee is really considering at the today anyway. And so I don't think we're running into that problem as of yet, but I appreciate bringing it to our attention. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Ms. Pontius. Just some additional questions. Is there a stacking of rights under subrogation, you know, the car insurer versus the health insurer versus someone else, the attorney that's helping in filing the claim? I mean, is there – who gets first dibs at the money under subrogation and – if we, and I'll just ask my second question, and maybe you can kind of answer both of them. And the second one was, you know, if the state said that these dollars are not subject to subrogation, so we block off the health insurers and the auto insurers from making claims on our state payments, does that in any way limit the credibility in the court of the state in its own attempt to do subrogation in terms of recovering from, you know, let's say the NTSB decides that the contractor on the bridge had some portion of the liability. If we said our special things are not subject to subrogation, will that be interpreted by the courts as you don't get to access this other pool either because of, you know, you've kind of created yourself as special. Since you didn't play in the normal game, we're not going to let you play in this game again. And so, I mean, I know it's theoretical, but if you could address that. But the first question was about the whole stacking of rights when you get to the actual settlements of these things.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I don't think there's anything specifically governing stacking of rights, and I'm not sure how it would play out if you had a number of insureds and there wasn't enough money there for all of them. They all have a right. I don't know if a court would apportion it among them based on sort of reverse comparative fault kind of analysis where, you know, if one insurer had paid $20,000 and another had paid $10,000, but there was only $10,000 available, you know, if they would each get their proportionate share of that $10,000 based on what they paid. I'm not sure how that would play out. And as far as the second point on the subrogation, the state wanting to play it both ways or whatever. Again, I think that's why you want to be really explicit in whatever you draft. If you start addressing subrogation issues, to address them at all levels. So that argument couldn't be made. You could say, well, these funds aren't subject to subrogation, but the state has a right of subrogation to the extent that other third parties are found to be liable for the underlying loss.
Thank you.
Other questions? Anything further?
Not for me, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that has something further? Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, I would just suggest that I think the next people who have something for you that's prepared would be Mr. Mossman and Ms. Roberts.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members, Matt Mossman, Senate Fiscal Staff.
And I'm Helen Roberts from the House Fiscal Staff.
Mr. Chairman and members, the last time the committee met, you had a presentation from the Department of Finance that went over a variety of scenarios, responses to tragedies, and how compensation packages or compensation responses were addressed in those situations. And I believe there was four of them at the time, and then there was also some conversation about how California responded to a bridge collapse. And that information was also provided. And in the course of pulling together that information, the Department of Finance used numbers of the 13 deaths, which is we're all aware of, and an assumption of 100 injured persons. And what we're here today is just to, obviously, the information that's been available in terms of any specifics, in terms of the number of injuries and what the nature of them has been, is still evolving. And we're just here to give you some information that we pulled together or were able to put together that might provide some kind of update as to what we know at this time. And I think that you all have in front of you a legal size document that just lists the let me tell you what we have here. What you have in front of you is we started with some, and obviously there's been an effort here on the part of everyone involved, both the sources of our information and us as well, to be cautious about proceeding with what is obviously a very sensitive situation to the victims and the people involved in a way that is respectful of the privacy of the individuals involved and the information that we have available for us as we try and work through what the cost impacts or the financial impacts of the various scenarios that you might be considering, what would be involved in regards to dollars. So what you have before you is we started with some information that we were able to obtain from the Minneapolis Police Department that really was just assembled as they triaged the site, the first response during the initial few days in terms of how they segmented the collapse site and just identified the vehicles and were able to check them off. And so what you have here before you on the left-hand side is MPD's marking system at that time. That's how this is organized. All of the personal information, names, et cetera, it has been removed here. And just identifies then in the fourth column over, if you will, what the initial injury information was at the time and the number of occupants that was that were in the vehicles, the number of injured and fatalities. What we've done since then is just supplemented that as we get information that, frankly, all of us have had an opportunity to see. I think the Star Tribune, as you know, did kind of an expose as they've been trying to learn information about the victims. We were able to glean some of that and supplement what we had available, as well as there's been constituent letters, and just tried to update the initial information that we had in terms of the number of injuries. So if I just were to jump down, I guess, quickly to the bottom of the third page, what we have here then in terms of total numbers, from what we're aware of at this point, there were 187, persons directly involved. They're on the bridge, in vehicles, or construction workers. Based on the information available and how we were able to update it, it seems clear that there was some extent of injury either reported initially or subsequently for 85 of those persons. So at that point, I guess to say that going back to what the Department of Finance was working with last week, we don't have any reason at this point to think that the 13 deaths and the 100 injuries that were assumed at that point in terms of putting those previous estimates together is out of range of what we're seeing. That seems to still be based on what I think is fairly preliminary and evolving information here to be in the ballpark. A couple of things that we just want to say about the information you have here. This is what you're going to get here is kind of a list of the caveats and the limitations, of which I think there are many in terms of how evolved this information is in terms of if one were to actually draw on it to estimate what the potential, the cost of any range of scenarios that you might consider would be. The first is that if you look, for example, I will just say the school bus, which is one-third of the potential victims and claimants, and at this point, of the 66 persons, the information you have before you identifies two with known injuries. Now, obviously, there's quite a number of people on here for which information is either unknown for whatever reason, but certainly there's potential claims in all of those areas where there might not be anyone identified as being injured yet at this point. Another particular area where our information is limited is construction workers. And just generally, again, to reiterate, there's persons who may have walked away and never went to the hospital. There's persons who, for whatever reason, might not really have been wanting to be contacted. There's people on here for which there's no information. We don't know. We may still get a claim from them, obviously. Or if there was a fund or other sort of compensation that you considered that was established, there may be persons who would surface that are not in these numbers at this point at the 85 count. Obviously, what's here is just relates to injuries, and we don't really have a mechanism at this point, and haven't attempted to, go to consider how do these injuries translate into actual medical costs, for example, in terms of what the dollar value of that would be. The information on what the nature of the injury is fairly limited as far as being able to do that kind of analysis. Property damage and personal possession loss, of which there is some information from various sources that I think we could start adding, but that's not on here yet. This is all based on medical and physical injury information that's available. Also then economic losses, lost wages, et cetera. That information isn't here. And finally, there's always the potential for secondary claimants, such as first respondents and others, that would have been involved. That is not here. So those are some of the caveats. I think at that point I will just it is what it is. It's evolving. We'll continue to try and as best we can in terms of, again, just being cautious about the confidentiality of the individuals, some that may be more willing than others to be forthright about what their personal information, their physical injuries, try and continue to improve on this information so that we can respond to whatever scenarios you might want us to look at. But this is what we have at this point.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Anything else? Representative Laffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our guests. Thanks for putting this together. I think we also need to note that the injury reports here are just from the press and from the first responders, and that may not, traumatic brain injury or some other sort of things are not the kinds of things that you would actually find on here. So I think there's some of those. In terms of the vehicle loss, we focused mostly, I think, in the past discussions about, health losses. But in terms of vehicles, most of those were insured, and from the press, at least, it appears that the insurance companies have stepped up and settled claims related to that. I assume that's also an area where we might have claims from, of subrogated claims from those insurance companies as well. Is that that expectation. Maybe it was in Mr. Watson's list, and I didn't focus on it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think that your comment question, I think, really goes at kind of the point or observation that we have here is that I think there's a number of once as proposals, it's kind of a give and take thing here in terms of as we assemble better information, we'll be able to better help gauge what the range of responses, what the impact of the range of responses that you might consider would be, but also in terms of as various options take shape in terms of the subrogation issues, the role of private insurance, et cetera, all of that will also play into what the cost impact might be, and so it's not really clear how that all might affect any cost estimates yet at this point.
Mr. Lendicke?
Well, Mr. Chair, I realize that the most important thing right now is the victims who were on the bridge and maybe first help providers who were injured or need money to be reimbursed. But won't there also be claims from businesses and people around both sides of the bridge whose businesses were impacted? And has anyone started looking at how many of those kinds of claims there might be?
Mr. Chair, I know that I believe that there's been at least one claim for a loss of business. I think the Department of Administration would be better placed to answer that question. We didn't attempt to include that in this information.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Watson, anyone else?
Mr. Chairman, that's everything I'm aware of that's been done, but we're available.
Okay.
I do have copies of the list that I think Risk Management and MnDOT put together of the claims that have been filed to date that include a number of subrogation claims and claims for property loss. It's about $104,000 worth of property loss so far, and presumably that will grow with time.
Okay. As the Claims Committee is going to deliberate a little bit as to what our recommendations or actions should be, I just wanted to thank the Governor's Office and the Department of Transportation, Department of Finance, for really working with Senator Lass and myself and trying to be creative. I know that we were asking them to try and come up with some funds on an emergency basis, not dealing with a lot of the other issues that are out there, and but yet focusing on trying to get some assistance. And I really appreciate the creativity that's been put on the table. Now we'll have to talk about a little bit more and see if we if it's something that we can continue to live with or work with. Senator Last, do you have a suggestion or any comments as to how you'd like to proceed?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think it's important for us to make sure that some of the issues that are raised in the proposal before the committee are thoroughly vetted, and as we noted, we kind of finalized some of these ideas, late last night and this morning. So I think maybe it would be appropriate now to take a recess and give an opportunity for some additional vetting of these proposed terms. Maybe a recess to the call of the chair, and then we could reconvene to see where things are at.
All right. Is there any discussion, members? Okay, we'll recess to the call of the chair.